So this talk has not the not unambitious title of What is Enlightenment, but I thought it appropriate for this festival, as that's what we're doing today. We're celebrating the Buddha's awakening, and it's also a good reminder of what we're about, what we're doing. I've often had people call the centre and ask for directions, and you could say we are in the business quarter of Norwich. So up on the corner of the road there is a solicitor who are in the legal business, and there's a letting agent next door, and there's various estate agents in the property business. Well, we're in the enlightenment business. So we're in the enlightenment business. And those working there, working at the centre, they could say that. They could, if they're asked what line of work they're in, they could say, well, I'm in the enlightenment business. Which would either be a good opener or a real conversation killer, depending who you're talking to. And even if you've not been coming along to the centre that long, but you feel inspired to engage with it, it's something worth thinking about, because if you do keep it up, people will ask you. And they'll ask you what enlightenment is. And I do remember very some sobering conversations when I first came along. I was very inspired by meditation, and I was really into it early on, and and learned a bit more about Buddhism. So I try and tell people and enthuse other people about that. So I do remember telling them, and then they say, so, well, What is enlightenment? I said, well, we don't really know. Well, does anybody know? Well, no, the Buddha didn't say. But that's what you're trying to do. And I say, yeah. So you don't know what it is. And I just feel my confidence just gradually taking away. My enthusiasm and inspiration was way ahead of my understanding. It's a little better now, but nowadays it's a bit different. I get in classes, people ask, so are you enlightened? And I'm not sure if they're disappointed or relieved when I say no. I think probably relieved. So I'm going to, I won't be giving any definitive answers, but hope to just open up the area and remind us of it, and maybe stimulate some interest. And I'll talk for about 40 minutes, just so you know. I'm often working out how long people are talking to, so how much I'm going to move around. And I'll talk in three areas. One is, say, perspective, what I'd call a perspective on enlightenment, and then there's the ways we practice, and then a bit about what it is. So, first of all, perspective. what it said, that the Dharma is universal, that it's a universal truth. That is how things are. And it's also said that we've all got the seed of enlightenment within us, and we all have that, which is something I can resonate with. I feel there's an often intuitive response to the Dharma, which I felt I had, and I see it in other people when we do classes here at the centre, and we talk about the Dharma, and so many times people say, I've always thought this is what I've always thought, but I've never been able to put it in those terms so clearly. So, if the universal truth is something we all resonate with, and in our short puja that we do, there's the line, the Buddha was born as we are born, what the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. So, implies that, well, we can all do it. We can all have the same realization that the Buddha had, and the Buddha laid out teachings to to follow, which have been followed for 2,500 years, and there's been a lot of people seriously practicing the Dharma. So you pull that together, you could ask, well, so where's all the enlightened beings then? Where are they all? If it all works and all people are practicing it. Well, historically there have been acknowledged to be, there's been people who've gained enlightenment after the Buddha. There doesn't seem to be that many around today. So, anyway, I think that's an interesting question. But then to answer that, I'd say you need to look at Buddhist cosmology to just realise that we need a much bigger perspective, and how our perspective and our view of, well, everything is very limited. So just talk a little bit about Buddhist cosmology. If you want to read more, I'll just point you in the direction of Sangharakshita's A Survey of Buddhism, where there's a good piece on Buddhist cosmology. So according to Buddhist cosmology, there's been no beginning to anything. It's just been an infinite number of world systems. I think there was a reading that Alokadhara did earlier on that as part of the Buddha's realization of enlightenment, seeing world systems that come into being and pass away over unimaginable periods of time. Not only material realms, but also spiritual realms. And it's said that as a material world develops, the spiritual realm, whatever the opposite to developing it is, that goes down as the material realm goes up. And we can't grasp the periods of time involved with this. I'll just quote a little bit from the survey, because once a bhikkhu once asked the Buddha that question. Well, they talked in terms of kalpas or eons, and so he asked a bhikkhu wanted an idea. Well, how long are we talking about? What is that? So I'll just read. I'll put my glasses on for that. So the Lord replied, "Long indeed is the aeon, brother. It's not easy to reckon it in this way. So many years, so many centuries, so many millennia, so many 100,000 years. But can an illustration be given, Lord?" "It can, brother," replied the Exalted One. "Just as if, brother, there were a mighty mountain crag, 4 leagues in length, breadth and height, without a crack or cranny, not hollowed out, one solid mass of rock, and a man should come down at it the end of every century, and with cloth of Benares he should once on each occasion stroke that rock. Sooner, brother, would that mighty mountain crag be worn away by this method, sooner be used up than the aeon. Thus long, brother, is the aeon of aeons. Thus long, many an aeon has passed away, and many hundred aeons, many a thousand aeons, many a 100,000 aeons." So it's a long time. I've just read that the period we're living in, I mean, it was just like a little tiny, very tiny time in history. Even going back to 2,500 years, to the time of the Buddha, it's a relatively short time in the grand scheme of things. Some kalpas don't have a Buddha. The Dharma has been lost. And that's why there's so much reverence towards the Buddha, because he rediscovered the Dharma. He didn't discover the Dharma, because the Dharma's as we said, a universal truth. It's always there. But he rediscovered it. So in that way, we live in a fortunate time. So you could say, well, all this, I mean, I know the ancient Indians were into big numbers and lots of proliferation like that in their thought. So we could think, well, all this talk of kalpas and aeons and what have you, is just a product of a very fertile ancient Indian mind. But just a dip into today's thinking on science and astronomy. Well, this is just as grandiose and mysterious. And then some of it is quite aligned to Buddhist thought. Modern science talks of galaxies coming into being, passing away, and there's been no beginning or end to that either. And then you get into quantum physics, where they talk of parallel universes, and a great mystery. You know, there's still lots of mysteries. Over a lot of years, I've been talking about this stuff called dark matter, which apparently makes up 80% of the universe. Well, some places said 76%, or 80%. How do they get that 4% difference? I don't know, because you can't measure it and you can't see it. But I heard on the radio the other day the latest thinking on this material that we can't see, we can't measure, actually doesn't exist at all. So there's a real mystery of what is going on. So I mention all of this just to have this perspective, and that we live in the very material times. There's two things. There's one, we're very fortunate. The Dharma is available to us. We're free to practice. We're not persecuted if we practice. We can even go up in the middle of Norwich and practice in the street, as some of you do. Even in these times of recession, most people have their basic needs met, so we are able to practice. But it's not a spiritual world we live in. And just reading a text about the time of the Buddha, life was a lot harder, life was a lot tougher. But you got the sense that it was a very spiritually supportive place to be at the time of the Buddha. The conditions were very conducive to spiritual practice. People were doing it. It was sort of in the air and encouraged, and there was a lot of search going on, which was very supportive. So that could be, I think that's an answer why, well, it's just a very difficult time we live in to get enlightened. It's not a spiritual world, it's not a spiritual realm that we're living in. And not to underestimate the pull of the materialism and the world around us. The views around us, our conditioning, other people, it all has a really big effect. As probably anybody who's been on retreat would know, you go on retreat, meditate a lot, there's much more supportive conditions, and so what you're doing, it can all make sense. It all makes sense, but then coming back and a few days later, you can think, well, what was that all about? And we easily forget. So not to underestimate just the effort that's needed, and the conditions we're in are difficult. In one ways, we're fortunate, but they are a very difficult world to practice in. And in the Tree Ratna Buddhist community, that's what the project's about, really, is how we can set up conditions that will help us and others to practice more effectively. In early on in the movement, years ago, they talked about the three C's, which you don't hear that much of now. The three C's were communities of people living together, cooperatives of people working together, or team-based right, they became more known as team-based right livelihood, and centres. So there's not communities and team-based right livelihoods aren't so popular as they used to be, but I think they will come. I think it will come back in. I think people will find a new way into them and want to live and work together to set up more supportive conditions. But we've certainly got centres. You know, certainly centres are still thriving. And that's what we're trying to do here at the centre, is just, well, setting up supportive conditions that will go against really what's pulling us away outside of that. And after a bit of clarification of what he's doing, he's not here today, but there was Robbie was setting up a wanted to come here and meditate with others on a Friday night. He wanted to do something along with others that were a bit more spiritually conducive to what they normally get up to on a Friday night. And I thought that was a really good idea and a good example of just recognising conditions that are going to help us and those that take us away, and just trying to put in place conditions that will help us grow and develop and practice. So that's a bit about our perspective. So I'm just going to talk a bit around just how we practice. So there's many models of what we do to realise the same thing as the Buddha. Many lists. Probably the most encompassing is the threefold way of ethics, meditation and wisdom, which I'm sure anybody who's come along even for a short time has heard about. So I'm going to talk about that, within the context of reminding us of enlightenment. So first of all, ethics. we're not practicing ethics just to be good people, although that does happen. Practicing the Dharma does work. It makes life work, even just on a mundane level. People come along. I see people who've got some difficulty or just finding they want something more in their life. They come along, learn a bit of meditation, so become a bit more aware, a bit more mindful, maybe do some metta bhavana, a bit more positivity, and then learn about Buddhist ethics. So they try and be a bit more generous, patient, truthful, other regarding. And then, yeah, life becomes more enjoyable and easier, and they find they're more happier. Then they stop coming, because that's sorted them out, really. And but that's okay, they'll be back. but what we're really trying to do is practice. We're really trying to practice an ethical life to align ourselves with how things are, with reality. So we're trying to practice an ethical life to align ourselves with the reality of how things are. And just to start to, and all that we do with that is to loosen this sort of tight grip, the tight view we have of our fixed self of ourselves, fixed sense of ourselves. I want to talk about ethics. It's not just limited to the five precepts. It's, when we talk of Buddhist ethics, it's our whole life, just how we live our life. And meditation, there's a sort of a bit of a feedback loop goes on with meditation. So we meditate and become a bit more aware and a bit more sensitive, ethically sensitive, so then we can make some changes. We become more aware and make changes in our life, and then we find that, well, our mind isn't so assailed by the hindrances if we make those changes. We might live our life a bit simpler,
calm down, we find it easier to meditate, become a bit clearer, then we further change things in our life. So that sounds all very straightforward and simple, and in some ways it is. But it's also very complex, because we are complex, and the modern world is complex. And other people, well, they're really complex. And I think, Sangha actually had seen that. He wrote a sonnet in 1956, so that would have been when he was in Kalimpong in India, and it's sort of alluding to that. So I'll just read that couple of verses. Reading some books, you'd think the Buddha way, as though macadamized, ran smooth and white, straight as an arrow, billboards left and right, and that the yellow buses thrice a day whirled past the milestones whose smug faces say, Nirvana, 15 miles by 10 tonight. You'll all be there, good people, and alight, outside the Peace Hotel where you're to stay. But those who read their own hearts inly wise know that the way's a hacked path, roughly made, through densest jungle, deep in the unknown, and that, though burn 1,000 baleful eyes, like death lamps, round, serene and unafraid, man through the hideous dark must plunge alone. So it's not just a smooth road that we just follow. It's a hacked path which we must plunge alone. So though we do it with others, we're the only ones that can do it. Nobody else can do it for us. It's up to us. And all the practices we do, we have to, they're all laid out, but we have to find our own way into them. We have to make them our own. And there's we need to learn a flexibility, and we need other people for guidance as well, and help and support, because at times it's sometimes very obvious what we're doing, and we can be very inspired, enthusiastic, and then it can just be like this great thicket of jungle where we're just trying to hack our way through. In a way, that's you could say that's, we develop shraddha or confidence or trust, that when we hit this great jungle, this thicket, well, we know, this is what we've hit now, and we, rather than, oh no, we've gone wrong, we need to, this is going to be a difficult period, we've got to get through it. Just thinking of the need to, I was thinking of, we do it on our own, but then also with other people. And the Dharma does seem to be, somebody pointed out to me the other day, it's what we teach here, it can seem to be full of contradictions. We say that, but then there's this. We need a great effort and resolve. But all we need to do is relax and let go. The Buddha pointed out the importance of solitude, going to a place of solitude on our own. He also said friendship is all of the spiritual life. And Sangharakshita, our teacher, he once talked about work, and talked about the best thing of the work is just to do as little as possible, as little as we can get away with. But he also said work as the tantric guru. And one person said they went to see him, and he said to them, well, we have a saying in our movement, it's work, work, and more work. I think that was quite personal to this person, to hear that. And then we talk about the importance of dhyana, or absorbed states in meditation. But then, don't chase after experience and don't get attached to them. So they're not actually, if you think about it, they're not contradictional or even opposites. It's just it's because of our tendency towards literalism, that we need different things at different times, and we need to be aware of both sides. And maybe one time we need to put loads of effort, in other time we just need to let go. So it's just knowing when the, not the bamboo, but whatever it is, has blown in one direction, it needs to blow back in the other, just to get it straight. So we need the flexibility in our own practices. So I was just talking about absorbed states in meditation, or dhyana. So that leads on to, lead me on to meditation. So meditation is an important tool for working directly on our minds. I think it's in meditation that we really give ourselves the best chance to be more aware and clear of how our mind works, and to be more creative, and we can have a creative response to whatever affects our mind. And we do the metta bhavana. Again, this is, you could say, we're aligning ourselves with reality. That's just from a dharmic point of view of how things are, when we're doing the metta bhavana, to realize that more and more. And also for just enjoyment and pleasure. I know that isn't the case for some people. Some people do find meditation just a bit of a slog, and I think it can just be a temperamental thing. But it can be, well, I do find it something really enjoyable, and we need, that's what we're looking for. We need enjoyment and pleasure in our practice. But more and more refined enjoyment and pleasure. And if we, another model of moving towards enlightenment is the nidanas, nidana chain. And joy and tranquility is right up there. So in order to have really, to really see into how things are, we need really positive and blissful states of mind. I mean, you might be able to, but I know for some people, say meditation is difficult, but you need to have that in mind, and that's what we're aiming for. So you might be able to do that other ways, reflection and just finding more stillness and quiet in your life. So one of the things I was talking about, the apparent contradictions, was the importance of dhyana, or higher states of consciousness. But then also not chasing after them or getting attached to them. And even if you, or if you, if you're not someone who's never experienced anything like that in meditation, well, not getting too, not worrying about it, basically, not that thinking you have to have that. So that used to be a real distraction for me. I was always inspired by stories about great meditators. I remember reading about Han Shan, who, he was a Chinese practitioner who went up in a hut in the mountains and had his, was cooking his rice, then he put that to one side to meditate, and he entered deep samadhi, deep concentration. And when he came round, just everything, his cooking pots were all covered with a layer of dust because he'd just been meditating so long. And I thought, that's going to be me. And, I'm looking forward to, you know, that time. But it goes along with everything else we're doing, and we can't take that in isolation. I was recently supporting a retreat, Padmaloka, on the Anapanasati retreat, and the person leading it was quite experienced, and he said after a few days, yeah, don't come looking for experience, looking for a big experience. And it was very timely, because I was on the team, we do meditation interviews, It's all in silence, but we talk to people about their practice. And I realised, yeah, everybody's, even though they're working against it, they're looking for that big experience. They're wanting something big to happen. Well, some of them quite explicitly once said, well, I'd be really... He came in one day with a big smile on his face, and it'd been quite absorbed in meditation, and for him that was enough. He said, I'd have been really disappointed if I'd have come here and not had that. So, but why are we trying to get absorbed and experience that in meditation? Well, it is just to give us a flexibility of mind, a clarity, in order to reflect, in order to see things as they really are. But it can also be really enjoyable and become an end in itself. And what I'd realised on this retreat is that looking for an experience like that, people miss actually what's going on. So there is a lot going on which is really rich, but looking for something, looking for the big experience in meditation, they've actually missed it. They've missed what's there. So it needs just to be, you just do the practice, be open, and, well, it will sort itself out in a way. And the real change and transformation takes place just in our everyday mind, just noticing our thoughts, our feelings, emotions coming and going. And again, then we can just start to loosen our attachment to them, realizing, oh well, they're not me as I thought they were. And that's the insight, that's really getting to grips with them. So meditation helps support that, and being on a retreat, the whole process slows down, there's lots of silence where we can, you know, can experience that in a much more focused way. Rather than, and I sort of mentioned that just because I know I've spoken to a few people lately who've, well, either you think, well, they're really quite, they're all geared up just having these big experiences, or others that are a bit despondent that they never have them. But we need to think about, well, what is it we're trying to do? So I'll read a bit of Han Shan. Han Shan, well, his name means silly mountain, so it's worth reading it just for that, really. But he was a Chinese practitioner who became a hermit eventually up in the mountains. But he was definitely on a spiritual search with a friend. And they were waiting. He was waiting with a friend who didn't appear. This is just the little where the story gets to. So he decided to go up to this mountain on his own. So it's just about a page and a half, I'll read that, where he goes up to meet and meets another hermit. So after a long wait, Master Han Shan one day wandered to Pan Shan Mountain and climbed until he reached its peak. By the side of the peak, a hermit lived in a stone cave. His head was grey and his face was the colour of earth. Master Han Shan saluted him, but the hermit did not respond and remained silent. Master Han Shan, he was no ordinary man, and sat down near him. After a while, the hermit made some tea, took a cup, poured the tea and drank it. Master Han Shan also took a cup, poured some tea and drank it. After tea, the hermit put the cup back and continued his meditation as before. Master Han Shan did the same. Later, the hermit cooked rice, and when it was ready, he put it before his seat, took a bowl and chopsticks and ate. Master Han Shan also took a bowl and chopsticks and ate. After the meal, the hermit sat as before. Master Han Shan did the same. At night, the hermit went for a walk. Master Han Shan followed him, but went in the opposite direction. The next day at tea time, Master Han Shan boiled tea, and at meal time he cooked rice. The hermit drank tea and ate rice with him, and at night they both went out and walked as they had done the previous night. This continued for 7 days. Then the hermit began to ask, "Virtuous one, where do you come from?" Master Han Shan replied, "From the south." The hermit asked, why did you come here? Master Han Shan replied, "To seek you, the hermit." The latter said, "The hermit's face is like this and has nothing peculiar." Master Han Shan said, "The first day I entered this cave, I immediately uncovered the hermit." The hermit smiled and said, "For over 30 years I've lived in this cave, and only now have I met one of my line." And he invited Han Shan to stay with him, and the guest forgot about his return. One night, Master Han Shan went out and walked as usual. Suddenly, his forehead burst with a noise like thunder. Everything, including mountains, rivers, the earth, his body, mind, and the universe itself, disappeared entirely. That voidness was not comparable to ordinary empty space. This state of still voidness lasted about the time it would take 5 inches of incense to burn. Gradually he felt the presence of his body and mind and the firm stance of his feet on solid ground. Opening his eyes, he gradually saw again the mountains, rivers and the earth. Everything that had surrounded him previously returned to normal. His body and mind became light and joyful, and the effect of all this was indescribable. He moved his feet to walk and felt they were as light as air. When he returned to the cave, the hermit asked, "Why did your stroll last so long tonight?" Master Han Shan told him about what had just happened, and the hermit said, "This is only the manifestation of the aggregate of form, and is not your real nature. I've been here for over 30 years, and except when the wind blew or it rained or snowed, I've had the same experience every night while walking. If one does not allow oneself to be attracted by it, it will not obscure one's fundamental nature." Master Han Shan accepted the hermit's teaching, bowed and bowed his thanks. So, if you have any experiences like that, well, enjoy them, but don't get attached to them. And well, talk to other people. You might find they'll say, "Well, I get it every Tuesday night after Sangha night, walking home." So I've emphasised that point of just meditation. And enlightenment is to become more aware of our mind, to develop a flexibility and a clarity in our mind, and well, we may experience other states within that, or we may not. But the main thing is that we're to have in mind what we're doing. So now we'll just move on to say a bit about the wisdom. Some people say they find Buddhism too intellectual. Well, it could be, I suppose, depending on how you approach it. But in order to see things how they really are, we need to know what we think and how we interpret the world. We all tell a story. We all have a view about ourselves and the world. And we also have the Dharma, which points us in the direction of reality, of how things are. So we need to know, we need to know ourselves, we need to know what we think. And that's why we have so much emphasis on discussion. And we do that in order to, well, first of all, to clarify, you can't even miss it that we even have a view. We might think, well, things are just as they are, but actually all they are is views. So we need to clarify our views and then become aware, well, is this what we call right view that has taken us towards enlightenment, or is it a wrong view? So we're not doing discussion and study to catch us out, but it's actually to clarify, well, what we think, and is what we think helpful or unhelpful. Initially that will be, probably will be, just on an intellectual level, just like, say, impermanence. We can know everything is impermanent, but there's a difference between knowing it and realizing it. But if we keep studying that, discussing it, when we have an experience of some sort, we've got something else to, we've got a context to put it in, we've got a framework. I was talking to somebody earlier on about Christian mystics, and it's interesting, you can read about Christian mystics, and they have some quite profound experiences which seem to be quite aligned to reality, to how things are, but the context they had to put them in was Christianity. That's how they interpreted them, because that's all they'd got. Well, sometimes they couldn't align it with that, and they were moving away from that. Then they'd be in trouble with the Christian authority of the day, because that was undermining the Christian teaching. So we need to know what we think, and we need to know the Dharma in order to put that in within that context, how we interpret our experience. Because we probably have insights into reality a lot of the time, all of the time. But it's not somewhere else, it's all around us. Reality is here. And we just create, so what we're doing is creating the conditions of our inner conditions and the outer conditions where we can learn to see that more clearly, so it becomes transformative. So stream entry is the point where, on the way to enlightenment, where we break the first three fetters of fixed self-view, doubt and reliance on rules and religious rituals as ends in themselves. And until we reach that point, you know, we can have these realizations, but we forget them. They're not transformative. But after that point, there's something that sticks, and we have a bigger perspective. There's something that's we've really seen it. It's been said that, I mean, I used to, you can read about these Zen masters of this big flash of insight, and when they finally get it and see it. But it's been said, and it makes more sense to me, that this is a slow, gradual process. And we keep having little insights, and they build. And then we're setting up conditions where we can assimilate them more and more. And we may not even notice it. We could even gain insight. We could even break the three fetters and not realize it. But look back. We could look back at a time when, something. I've changed. Something's really changed, and we hadn't even noticed it happen, as it's a gradual process. But look back on it when there was a really big shift in our experience. So now I'll just finish with talking briefly about what is enlightenment. Well, we don't really know. no, I also we do. Actually, there has been things said about it, but it has been said it is beyond words. And often, particularly in more traditional text, is quoted in the negative, as in the cessation of passion, the cessation of aversion, confusion, But our tendency towards the negative, it can become more, people can develop a more nihilistic view of Buddhism because of that. But there is a lot of other positive, mostly poetic images, which the Buddha talked about, of the cool cave, which would have been very attractive. That might not sound a great place to go for us, but in the Buddha's day that would have been a very attractive proposition. The place of bliss, freedom, the calm, the end of suffering, the supreme joy. So you can read a lot more, and again it is in the Survey of Buddhism, there's a lot more descriptions of the positive aspects of enlightenment. And I've noticed in our movement, in the Triratna Buddhist order, well, it might have always been there, but I've only just, the last few years, there is a lot more talk these days of insight. And it could be due to the, well, it could be people are getting on a bit and thinking, well, they've got to, if they're going to get it, they need to get it now. So it's become a bit more urgent. But I'd say more, that there's just a maturity and depth of practice. People have been practicing quite a long time, and actually quite intensively and seriously. So that will bear its fruit. And actually I think people have started to have, well, you could say insights with a small eye, and they've really, you know, have a lot more confidence and faith in that. It can be another of those opposites or contradictions of, some say, well, you know, they don't like to talk about insight because it becomes egotistical. And I think it is too, if we get too caught up in thinking about I'm going to gain insight, it can be something we just want to add on to ourselves. It's just something, rather than seeing through a fixed sense of ourselves, it's just something we want to add on. So if we get too caught up in it, it's because it's a letting go of ourselves as the insight, rather than it's us that are going to do it. But if we're too coy about it, well, you can forget what you're doing. You know, we can, if we're too coy and think, well, we don't want to mention it, we can forget what we're doing. And actually, it can be, I'd find it very inspiring to talk about people when they've been on retreat, about their insights, and you can compare their experience with your own. And I think that there's quite a lot happening at the moment. So I think it can be a great source of encouragement and inspiration. And it's said that if we sincerely and consistently practice the Dharma, success is assured. As I said earlier on, it is a universal law. So if we practice the Dharma in accord with that universal law, is only going to go in one direction, as opposed to material success, which is, well, it changes, it's subject to the worldly winds. We may be successful in the world, we may not, whereas practicing the Dharma, success is assured. If we practice in accordance with that, it will eventually, we will move closer and closer to insight, into reality, and then eventually we will know for ourselves what enlightenment is.